In the long and catastrophic age through which mankind has endured, few living souls can claim to grasp more than a fragment of the Emperor's grand design for the galaxy. Yet in hindsight, some truths emerge from the patterns of history. Many believe that each of the great Space Marine legions of the first founding was shaped with a specific purpose in mind, and the deeds and demeanor of those legions lend weight to this belief. The Imperial Fists stood as the Emperor's Praetorians and champions, steadfast and unyielding. The Ultramarines marched as his resplendent hosts, exemplars of order and dominion. To the 19th Legion, however, fell a quieter burden, the role of the Emperor's hidden hand. They were to be the unseen sentinels, the silent executioners who watched, judged, and struck down those who would flee rather than kneel before the master of mankind. From their earliest days, the Proto-Legion drew upon the temperament of the techno-savages of old Earth, from whom its first warriors were taken. These origins shaped a legion uniquely suited to reconnaissance, infiltration, and the identification of vital targets. The warriors of the 19th Legion learned to exist in stillness, observing with cold patience, only to transform in an instant into instruments of devastating violence. They did not wage war through grand advances or overwhelming displays of force. Instead, they slipped unseen into position, studied their enemies with relentless scrutiny, and waited. When the moment came, they struck from the least expected quarter, annihilating their foes in assaults that were as brief as they were bloody. During the unification of Terra, some enemies of the Emperor believed they could defy his destiny through open resistance. Such illusions endured only until the moment the 19th Legion revealed itself, already poised like a loaded weapon pressed against the temple of its victim, the assassin unseen until the killing blow was delivered. Faced with such mastery of infiltration and annihilation, most adversaries capitulated without battle. The Legion was not wantonly cruel. As emissaries of the Emperor, its warriors would reveal themselves only when necessary, offering a final choice: kneel in obedience or die. Many chose service. Others refused, and for them, the 19th Legion emerged from the shadows in full. When unleashed, they attacked without warning. Their methods allowed them to engage and defeat forces far larger than their own. Through precise campaigns of assassination, enemy leadership was erased, and without command, armies collapsed in disarray. Should resistance persist, the Legion withdrew, not in retreat, but into concealment, only to strike again from a different direction. Their enemies were bled dry, denied rest, denied recovery, denied even the hope of counterattack. How many wars were won in this silent manner during the final years of the Unification Wars could never be known. So often, the hand of the 19th Legion remained unseen even after victory was secured. Only much later, after reunion with their Primarch, would the Legion emerge more fully into the light. But even then, They shunned praise and rarely sought recognition. Much of the Legion's earliest history remains shrouded, but certain truths are known. The Emperor recruited the first warriors of the 19th Legion from several regions of Old Earth, most notably from the Zarek tribes of the Asiatic dust fields. These were savage, yet technologically adept peoples who waged constant war against one another and against the vast Indonesic bloc with relentless ferocity, driven by competition for scarce resources. When the Emperor and his Thunder Warriors brought the Zarek tribes to heel, their firstborn sons were surrendered to the Gene Forges. Transformed into Astartes, these same sons were then returned to enforce Imperial compliance upon their own fractured kin. The Zarek warriors proved well suited to the Emperor's purpose. Yet some noted a cruel edge to their nature when ordered to attack, as well as a disdain for those they deemed weak. Among the Zarek, a defeated enemy was never forgotten. They were watched ceaselessly, and any sign of rebellion was crushed without mercy, lest the vanquished rise again. The 19th Legion inherited this philosophy, bound with the power and discipline of the Legion's Astartes. It became one of the Legion's defining traits. One of the earliest campaigns in which the 19th Legion took part was the conquest of the Central Asiatic region, much of it ruled by the tyrants Kalagan of Ursh. Few detailed records survive, yet what is known reveals a pattern that would define the Legion's operations for decades to come. First came the identification of key targets and weaknesses within Ursh's armies. Then the Legion dispersed, small battle groups infiltrating the region and taking up concealed positions. When the order was given, the attack came with devastating speed. Kalagan's warlords were slain, and his armies, broken and leaderless, were driven into a vast prison camp at the heart of the devastated region. It is said that Kalagan wielded weapons wrought through Psyker craft, and that the 19th Legion bore the brunt of their effects. Many veterans emerged from the campaign, marked by a darkness from which they never fully recovered. Some would later perish in suicidal charges, while others became the grim and solitary Moritats of the Legion. With Old Earth largely unified, the 19th Legion was committed to operations across the Sol system. When the Emperor's forces encountered Xenos powers controlling settlements within the Jovian range, the Legion was tasked with the scouring of the moon of Lysithia. Of this campaign, almost no records remain. Whatever transpired upon that distant satellite resulted in total victory. Xenos annihilated, but at a catastrophic cost. The human settlers were slain, and vast numbers of the 19th Legion fell alongside them. In the aftermath, many veterans of Lysithia were withdrawn from service by the masters of the Gene Forges, never to return. No other instance like it is recorded, and what horrors they endured or committed remains unknown. For decades afterwards, survivors bore the ancient Jovian rune upon their armor, crowned by the numeral 19. By the closing years of the Great Crusade, the symbol endured only upon the sarcophagi of the Raven Guard's dreadnoughts. Among them was Shade Captain Voltaris, who had played a decisive role in the campaign. Grievously wounded, Voltaris was interred within a Furbundus dreadnought and served for many decades more, until his final death before Gate 42. The 19th Legion was formed late in the Unification Wars, and nearly two centuries would pass before they were reunited with their Primarch. By contrast, the Luna Wolves were reunited with Horus Lupercal early, and in the opening campaigns of the Great Crusade, it was not uncommon for the two legions to fight side by side. Their methods complemented one another. While the Luna Wolves delivered sudden, overwhelming assaults, the 19th Legion was already in place, blocking escape routes, hunting down stragglers, and ensuring that none fled the Emperor's justice. Those who broke through were pursued without mercy. Captives were watched with unblinking vigilance until Imperial compliance was assured. The Legion's ability to shift from silent observation to lethal violence made it a source of dread among those who resisted unity. Horus valued the 19th Legion greatly and often requested their presence during the early Great Crusade. Many worlds rejected the Imperium, and the blade of the Legion descended unseen. Where compliance was freely offered, the blade withdrew without being noticed at all. Though the Luna Wolves swelled in number with recruits from Chthonia, the 19th Legion remained small, its identity rooted firmly in its Terran origins. Some noted that Horus treated the Legion as though it were an extension of his own. While the Luna Wolves' culture evolved, shaped by Chthonian savagery, the 19th Legion remained bound to the traditions of the Zarek tribes. Their armor stayed gray, though warriors often painted their faces with Asiatic dust before battle. From this came the Luna Wolves' names for them, the Pale Nomads, the Dust Clad. Under the influence of their gene seed, many legionaries grew unnaturally pale. Some saw their hair darken to black as night. In rare cases, eyes turned entirely black, lending them an unsettling, watchful aspect. Only later, with the return of their Primarch, would the full significance of these traits be revealed. Before the Emperor's dream had taken its first true steps beyond Terra, before the Imperium had even drawn its first breath, the Primarch Corvus Corax was already lost. While still an infant, he was taken from the Emperor's gene laboratory deep beneath the Himalayan mountains on Terra. In an act of defiance against the master of mankind, the ruinous powers of chaos violated the wards that protected the Emperor's gene forges. They seized the gestation chamber that held the Primarch and cast it screaming through the warp, flinging it across the galaxy. Where the infant emerged from that hellish transit was a place of darkness and despair, a lightless cavern far beneath the surface of Lycaeus, a barren yet inhabitable moon orbiting the industrial world of Kievar. At that time, Kyivar was a technologically advanced world. Its vast manufactoria supplied by endless minerals drawn from Lycaeus above. The moon itself was riddled with mines, worked by legions of enslaved laborers whose lives were spent beneath the iron gaze of their masters. Above the cavern where Korax was found lay a massive glacier, sealing the chamber away from the world. Had fate turned slightly, the Primarch might never have been discovered at all. Yet within solar minutes of the infant attaining consciousness, a team of Lycaean miners arrived while pursuing a mineral seam. To some, the timing spoke of greater forces at work, though the truth can never be known. What is known is that the slaves took the child in and hid him from the Kyivaran overseers. Lycaeus was populated by criminals, political dissidents, failed workers, and enemies of the ruling tech guilds. People condemned to live lives of brutal labor, watched constantly by armed guards. Like many of his kind, Korax matured at an unnatural pace, growing to adulthood in a preternaturally short span of time. To the enslaved, this only confirmed what they had already come to believe, that the child was a gift, a deliverer sent to free them. They named him accordingly, using their word for savior. Though created with immense knowledge already imprinted within his mind, Korax learned much from those who protected him. Many among the slaves were political radicals, condemned for beliefs that crashed with the brutal efficiency of Kyivar's ruling tech guilds. Ideas of justice, dignity, and human worth that had no place in their regime. To these people, Korax swore an oath. He would free them. Yet, those same men and women urged caution. They taught him patience. They taught him to watch, to plan, to observe his enemies with care and restraint. Under their guidance, Korax learned to temper his power, using his superhuman faculties not for reckless vengeance, but for preparation. He waited, learning everything he could of the systems that bound Lycaeus in chains. It was during this time that Korax came to understand the strange abilities with which he had been endowed. He was never discovered by the wardens of Lycaeus, no matter how closely they watched. Even when standing directly within an enemy's line of sight, Korax could will himself unseen, bending the perceptions of those who looked upon him. In time, he learned to move freely through the prison moon, walking unseen beneath the guards' watchful eyes. Yet there were limits. Machines still detected him. Auspexes and artificial sensors remained blind to deception. It was the minds of observers that were tricked, compelled to disregard his presence if he chose it. As Korax reached full maturity, the rule of the tech guilds drew inexorably towards its end, though they would not realize it until it was too late. He orchestrated a campaign of precision and restraint, leading small cells of freedom fighters on missions to steal weapons, acquire ammunition, and sabotage vital systems. each strike carefully timed to weaken the prison's foundations. At last, the moment came. Korax led the uprising that shattered centuries of oppression. The battle for Lycaeus was fierce and bloody. Not all slaves were idealists or innocents. Many were murderers and worse, imprisoned for crimes rather than beliefs. Necessity forced Korax to use their strength, demanding only that once freed, they never return to their former crimes. It was in the immediate aftermath of this victory, amid the opening atomic bombardment of Kievar, that the Emperor arrived to reclaim his lost son. Unlike many such reunions, the Emperor came alone. He departed alone the next solar day. Though father and son spoke for long hours, none know what words passed between them. Some have claimed the Emperor revealed truths to Korax that even other Primarchs were not ready to hear, of the warp, of the darkness to come. Whatever was said, Korax was left with a task unfinished. The Emperor entrusted him to complete the liberation of Kievar alone, as though ensuring his son would learn the most terrible lesson of war. Left behind, Korax made use of weapons the Tech Guilds believed beyond the reach of slaves. Stockpiles of atomic warheads and mining charges hidden on Lycaeus. When the Tech Guilds attempted a counterattack, Korax gave the order that would define him forever. Using the gravity well binding Kievar and its moon, Korax unleashed a full atomic bombardment upon the planet's manufactoria cities. Countless died, but countless more were spared a lifetime of slavery. By slaying thousands, he saved millions. The Tech Guilds capitulated. Kievar was freed. Lycaeus was renamed Deliverance, and its black tower became the Ravenspire, the fortress monastery of the Raven Guard. Korax had learned the truth the Emperor had intended, that war often demands the suffering of the innocent for the survival of all. When Corvus Korax assumed command of the 19th Legion in 922 M31, the Great Crusade was already more than a century old. He swiftly imposed upon his legion the methods he had perfected on Lycaeus. In doing so, he purged much of the legion's older culture, particularly the cold-blooded traditions inherited from the Xeric tribes. Korax saw in some of his Terran warriors echoes of the Kievar enslavers he had overthrown. Several senior officers were removed or reassigned, including Lord Arcus Fall, who had commanded the Legion for 3 decades. Under Korax's guidance, distilled into battle mantras, the Raven Guard refined their skills to preternatural levels. Korax even defeated Rabute Gilliman 3 times within the Ultramarine Primarch's Strategio Simulcra. Employing unconventional troop formations Gilliman had never encountered. Once Gilliman adapted, however, Korax never defeated him again. The Legion commissioned new technologies from Mars, most notably the Shadowhawk gunship and the Whisper Cutter insertion craft. These machines, many designed by Kievaran artificers, elevated the Legion's mastery of stealth to unprecedented heights. Kievar itself became a crucial industrial world, fiercely independent of Mars and loyal only to the Raven Guard. Its sole external alliance lay with Griffon IV, whose Titans fought alongside the Legion in several campaigns. Among the Raven Guard's notable campaigns was the Imperial compliance of the Istvan system. Istvan III possessed a cohesive industrial society, but its mysticism and independence led it to reject the Imperial truth. Charged with achieving compliance without excessive destruction, Korax deployed surgical strikes. Infrastructure was destroyed, leadership seized, and resistance crushed at Riddarth Valley. The Istvanians surrendered and were welcomed into the Imperium. Vardis Prawl was appointed planetary governor, tasked with dismantling the planet's religious structures, unknown at the time to be a chaos faith dedicated to Slaanesh. 15 years later, Korax would return to the Istvan system once more, not to bring compliance, but to bring judgment on the traitor Horus. There came a moment, quiet at first, almost unremarkable, in the long grind of the Great Crusade, when necessity demanded that the 19th Legion wage war in a manner that ran against its nature. And from that need came one of the greatest setbacks in the Legion's history, a bitter omen that would foreshadow the horrors of Istvan V only a few standard years later. Soon after, Horus Lupercal was declared Imperial War Master at the Triumph of Ulinor in 0M31. The Raven Guard were recalled from operations along the coreward edge of the Ghoul Stars. They were ordered back into the line, brought under the War Master's direct command beside several other legions. Their Shadow War traded for a place in a more conventional theater of conflict. The trouble lay in the Occam Sothos cluster. These worlds had been brought to Imperial compliance by the Luna Wolves in the opening years of the Great Crusade, claimed and secured for Terra. Yet now their people had fallen into a state of mass psychosis, and with shocking violence, they rejected unity with the Imperium. This secession was unheralded, sudden and disastrous, its true cause discovered only later. Xenos parasites had taken root among the population. They matured within the eye sockets of their hosts, those unfortunate souls who lived across the cluster. And as they grew, they gained rudimentary control over the bodies they inhabited. Through that control, they formed what amounted to an alien gestalt consciousness, a collective will focused through a cabal of primary hosts known as the Unsighted Kings. Horus refused to allow worlds he had personally brought to compliance to slip from the Imperium's grasp. Newly ascended as War Master, he vowed an oath of moment to reclaim the cluster no matter the cost. He devised a plan, a lightning war meant to cast down the Unsighted Kings swiftly. It would purge the afflicted population while preserving the cluster's highly developed infrastructure for future repopulation. And beyond the tactical purpose, a rapid victory would prove something else as well. It would demonstrate to Horus's brother Primarchs that the Emperor had been correct to elevate him above them. The War Master's strategy demanded the convergence of the bulk of four Legions Astartes: the Luna Wolves, Space Wolves, Iron Warriors, and Raven Guard, upon the heavily fortified lair of the Unsighted Kings. The outer worlds of the cluster were brought to heal in only solar weeks. And with that done, Horus called a council of his Primarch brothers. It was there that one part of his plan was laid bare. The Raven Guard to make a frontal assault directly into the guns of the defenders of Gate 42. Korax opposed it at once. He denounced it as a waste, an unnecessary squandering of resources and lives. He offered an alternative more aligned with the 19th Legion's nature. The Raven Guard would draw off enemy forces through feints and misdirection, bleeding the defenders out of position so the other three legions could overwhelm what remained at the walls with comparative ease. But Perturabo of the Iron Warriors accused Korax of seeking to avoid battle. He framed it as cowardice, as a crime that brushed the edge of dereliction for a Primarch of the Legion's Astartes. The exchange ignited with such heat that the two nearly came to blows. Only the intervention of Lehman Russ prevented bloodshed. Russ counseled Korax to heed the Primarch the Emperor had placed above his brothers. He urged the Raven Lord to smother his bitterness, but not to extinguish it. Let that guttering flame become fuel enough to carry the battle through. Korax left the council and mustered his legion before Gate 42. Knowing that certain elements of the 19th Legion still carried a particularly savage demeanor, Korax assigned many of his Terran-dominated companies to the vanguard, especially those captains who seemed most willing to enact the War Master's plan. What followed was remembered as the Raven Guard's darkest hour, a grim honor that would only be replaced a few Terran years later at Istvan V. The assault smashed forward into overwhelming fire. Companies were shattered. Assault elements were decimated. The attack faltered under the defenders' guns. And at the height of that brutal grind, when the Raven Guard were bleeding out into the broken ground before the walls, Korax himself led the Forlorn Hope. His battle cry ignited the 19th Legion into such a surge of effort that the breach was finally carried and Gate 42 taken. The honor of slaying the Unsighted Kings was claimed by Horus as War Master. At the moment of their execution, Xenos' control over the population was dispelled. The Occam Sothos cluster was delivered. Horus's prize was reclaimed, and with it, his honor. But the cost was terrible. Countless millions of hosts had been crippled in mind and body, their lives broken by what had lived behind their eyes. And thousands of Raven Guard lay dead before the shattered walls of Gate 42, the bulk of them Terran-born. Though the battle was counted a victory by Horus, its consequences ran deep. The 19th Legion was left sorely depleted. Reduced to only 80,000 legionaries under Korax's command, it became the smallest of the Legion's Astartes. Korax removed himself and his legion from his brother's command, swearing bitterly that he would never serve alongside Horus again. And one last consequence lingered long beyond the smoke of Gate 42. Many of the Terran line officers who had served for so long under Horus before the coming of Korax were gone, killed in the slaughter. With their deaths, the War Master was never able to exert much influence over the Raven Guard. Many of these Terran Astartes had been inducted into the Warrior Lodges, established within the 19th Legion. And with their destruction, those unseen bodies all but vanished from the Raven Guard. Detractors would later claim that in placing Terran-born legionaries at the front, where losses would be greatest, Korax had done his legion a service, consolidating his power and shaping the legion's future more closely to his own vision. As a result, the 19th Legion was largely spared the wave of insurrection later transmitted through so many other legions by the hidden auspices of the Warrior Lodges. A 2-standard-year engagement across a sector claimed by remnants of the broken Eldari species, the Skalland Campaign, became the original field test for the first 1,000 sets of prototype power armor crafted by the Mechanicum. Armor that would later be designated Mark VI Corvus Pattern, though at that time, it bore the provisional designation Mark V. Small numbers of the Mark V armor had already been given to the Iron Warriors and Salamanders. Both legions expressed reservations, concerned by the lack of heavy plating compared to earlier marks. They pressed for a revision that would better serve heavy assault roles. A mass combat trial was deemed necessary to judge the design before abandoning it. Internal politics among Primarchs and Legion commanders saw the honor bestowed upon the Raven Guard, already depleted after the Occam Sothos fighting. Speculation suggested that a faction led by Perturabo intended to hand the Mark V to an understrength legion, so the design would fail spectacularly, ensuring its replacement by a sturdier pattern. If that was the intention, it backfired. The Raven Guard performed admirably in the verdant Eldari seed worlds of the Skalland sector. The armor's advanced autosenses and enhanced agility suited their doctrine, enabling strike-and-fade warfare that hounded the Eldari and shattered their already battered forces. The campaign succeeded. The Eldari were expelled, and the Imperium claimed the sector's rich worlds. The Mark V prototype armor was approved for final deployment, and many improvements suggested by the Raven Guard were adopted. The armor was later dubbed Corvus Pattern, in honor of the Raven Guard's role in its testing and approval. It entered full-scale production on Mars only a few solar months before Horus's rebellion, and the Mechanicum redesignated it as Mark VI Corvus Power Armor, with the designation Mark V later applied to the stopgap field modifications and repairs common during the Heresy, known as Mark V Heresy Power Armor. When the Horus Heresy erupted, the Raven Guard were caught within the nightmare of the drop site massacre on Istvan V. 4 Space Marine Legions, Night Lords, Iron Warriors, Word Bearers, and Alpha Legion turned to chaos beneath the banner of the arch-traitor Horus Lupercal and betrayed their loyalist brothers, catching them in a terrible crossfire. The Raven Guard fought ferociously beside the Salamanders, the Iron Hands, but the losses were catastrophic. They were effectively crippled, unable to play any further constructive role in the defense of Terra. From a force of roughly 80,000, the 19th Legion was reduced to less than 3,000 survivors. In the Urgal Depression, Korax and Vulcan argued over what could still be saved. Vulcan urged a tactical withdrawal to their dropships and a dug-in resistance. Korax insisted the battle was lost, and that survival demanded escape. Unable to agree, Korax turned away and ordered the Raven Guard to retreat. A short while later, an atomic artillery strike hit the Primarch's position. By the grace of the Emperor, Korax survived. The fate of Vulcan was unknown at that time. The second wave of traitors turned fully on the Loyalists, slaughtering them in earnest. The Iron Hands were apparently slain to a man. Across the battlefield, Fulgrim and Ferris Manus, once as close as brothers could be, fought a titanic duel. Ferris Manus lost, and Fulgrim cleaved his head from his shoulders. Elsewhere, the Raven Guard were met by the Wordbearers, with Lorgar, Cor Feyran, and Erebus at their head. Their bitter clash saw the Wordbearers unleash the Galvor back, Astartes willingly possessed by demons. They attacked Korax en masse. Korax's prowess proved more than their numbers, and he slew them with impunity. Lorgar intervened to prevent the death of the remaining Galvor back, and dueled Korax directly. Korax quickly gained the upper hand. Lorgar, more scholar than warrior, was moments from execution when Conrad Kurz intervened and spared him. Kurz and Korax fought a brutal melee. Kurz gained the advantage and prepared to kill his battle-worn brother. But Korax escaped by taking to the sky with his mastercrafted jump pack. Loyalists were surrounded and butchered. Raven Guard and Salamanders refused to surrender, holding out as long as possible. With the arrival of Mortarion and Angron, supported by the Imperator-class Titan D.S. Irae, turned slaughter into pure annihilation. Tens of thousands of Loyalists died. Then Horus himself entered the killing ground at the head of the Jesteran, and the massacre reached its wrathful height. Any hope of escape was crushed when the Iron Warriors destroyed the Loyalists' first wave dropships. Loyalist ships in orbit were also largely annihilated. Yet some survived, miraculously slipping through the tightening cordon. The Raven Guard escaped more successfully than the Salamanders, and the Salamanders aided a few surviving Iron Hands to flee as well. Imperial history did not record the fate of the surviving Salamanders or Vulcan at the time. Vulcan had survived the atomic strike because he was a perpetual, capable of reincarnating after death, and was later captured and tortured by Conrad Kurz before escaping. Korax barely reached a fleeing Thunderhawk, but it was shot down almost immediately. The damaged gunship crashing near the Urgal Plateau. Korax survived the crash and gathered the remnants of his legion. He learned that a vast portion of the Raven Guard had been annihilated in the traitor's slaughter. The survivors fled into the highlands and shadows and were being hunted relentlessly. At one point, a roving Iron Warrior's armor column nearly discovered them, but the Raven Guard ambushed it and wiped it out before it could report. 30 solar days after the initial assault, Korax had received no word from Iron Hands or the Salamanders. He ordered the Raven Guard to dig in at the Lurgan Ridge, while he personally conducted reconnaissance of the original drop site. Using his innate psychic abilities to avoid detection, Korax reconnoitered the enemy positions around the fortified drop site. Though he told his warriors the mission was reconnaissance, his primary objective was to scour the Urgal Plateau for the bodies of his fallen Gene sons. But he failed to find them. After 98 solar days of pursuit, the Raven Guard were finally cornered on a windswept mountainside. Salt plains behind them, the World Eaters ahead. Angron strode at the head of his legion, roaring for blood. White and blue warriors spattered with gore surged up the slopes, tanks and guns laying down fire. Maddened by neural implants and driven by stimulants, they came to annihilate what remained of the Raven Guard. Then, salvation came from an unexpected quarter. Aircraft plunged from the clouds, missiles tearing through the World Eaters' ranks. Incendiary bombs erupted, scattering promethium across the slopes. Blistering plasma pulses descended from orbit, gouging trenches into Angron's army. Then dropships landed, black vessels bearing the badge of the Raven Guard. The survivors watched in stunned disbelief. This was a desperate rescue mission devised by Commander Brawne, a Raven Guard captain left in charge of deliverance. The survivors embarked without delay, broke for orbit, and escaped, leaving Angron baying in fury below. Unbeknownst to Korax, the Alpha Legion had infiltrated the Raven Guard during the drop site massacre. They surgically altered operatives to resemble dead Raven Guard Astartes and inserted them into the Legion amid the chaos of the chase. Alpharius Omegon had been informed by the Cabal that the 19th Legion would receive a valuable, top-secret Imperial asset. Impersonating Horus, the Alpha Legion's twin Primarchs ordered a pursuing World Eaters fleet to halt action against Brawne ships so the Raven Guard would survive and later come into possession of that future asset. An asset the infiltrators intended to steal. Korax did not know how Brawne reached Istvan V. He was grateful nonetheless. Brawne was reluctant to explain, considering the truth sensitive. He had acted only after repeated prophetic dreams experienced by Marcus Valerius, praefector of the Therian cohort, an Imperial army regiment attached to the Raven Guard fleet. Though absolution at Angron's hands might have been a righteous end, Korax was glad to survive and fight for the Emperor again. Back among the living, Korax reorganized what remained of his legion, including Brawne's forces from Deliverance. Fewer than 4,000 Astartes remained. Most were formed into the Talons, tactical companies under Captain Agapito. Assault survivors and several Dreadnought-interred veterans became the Falcons, led by Alani Tev. And remaining bike squads, land speeders, and aircraft crews were combined into the Hawks under Captain Solaro Ahn. The apothecaries had been targeted from the outset of Istvan V, and only 7 survived. Despite having only 15 standard years in the Apothecarian, Apothecary Vincente VI was appointed Chief Apothecary by Korax himself. Corvus Korax returned from Istvan V with ash in his lungs and ruin in his hands. More than 75,000 of his legion were gone, killed, scattered and erased from the order of battle in a single massacre that still burned behind his eyes whenever he closed them. The Ravenlord's grief did not settle into quiet mourning. It sharpened, it hardened, it became his obsession. And at the core of it all, there was Horus. Consumed by loss and haunted by the need for vengeance against the War Master, Korax ordered the survivors of the 19th Legion to return to Terra, for there was only one place left where a request of this magnitude could be made. He meant to ask the Emperor himself for aid in rebuilding the Raven Guard. The journey and the work were not clean. Delays came, setbacks followed, and on Terra, there were those who did not welcome Korax's plan with open arms. Rogel Dorn and Malkador the Sigilite disagreed with him, were displeased with what he sought and how he sought it. Yet Korax pressed on. Despite their resistance, Korax psychically communed with the Emperor. The Master of Mankind was devoting all his time to battling chaos within the warp, and to holding what remained of the secret Imperial extension into the webway together after Magnus the Red's catastrophic psychic intrusion to the Imperial Palace. Terra itself was a fortress under spiritual siege, and the Emperor's attention was divided between the physical Imperium and a war being fought in realms most could not even comprehend. Still, the Emperor answered Korax. And in that communion, the Emperor revealed truths that would have shattered lesser minds. He spoke of the Imperial project to control portions of the webway. He spoke of the nature of chaos. And he spoke of the truth behind the outbreak of what men were already calling the heresy. Not merely a rebellion or civil war, but an all-out campaign by the Chaos Gods to defeat the Emperor and enslave mankind, using Horus and the traitor legions as pawns. Then the Emperor chose to help, and he had another revelation. One astonishing enough to reframe what Korax believed possible. The Primarch Project's genetic assets had not been destroyed, as everyone had thought. They still existed, dormant, including living samples of the original, undifferentiated gene stock the Emperor had used to create the 20 Primarchs. The Emperor offered no explanation for why these facilities and this gene stock still remained. He demanded only one thing. This genetic material could never be allowed to fall to the wrong hands. So Korax assembled a strike force and descended into the deepest vaults of the Imperium's most sacred places. Accompanied by several Raven Guard squads, a contingent of Mechanicum specialists, and a number of custodians assigned as the Emperor's overseers, Korax located and entered the Emperor's well-protected gene laboratories deep beneath the Imperial Palace in the Himalayan mountains. The cost was paid in blood. The strike force suffered a number of casualties before they could breach and secure what lay within. But they succeeded. The original Primarch's gene stock and the technical information bound to it were secure. Korax and his warriors withdrew with the prize and returned to Deliverance, to the Raven Spire, and the cold work of remaking a legion. For several solar weeks, Korax labored alongside Chief Apothecary Vincente VI and Magos Genitor Nexand Orlandrius. They worked with the recovered Primarch DNA, pushing beyond what the Raven Guard had ever dared attempt in desperation alone, seeking not merely survival, but restoration. Then came the breakthrough. A new reservoir of stable Legion's Astartes gene seed was extracted from the original Primarch DNA. It was purer than the Raven Guard's existing gene stock, more pure than normal Raven Guard gene seed, because it came from undiluted, undifferentiated Primarch DNA, taken from the source before it had been broken down and altered with other genetic material into the 20 recombinant strands that birthed the Primarchs. They implanted it into 500 aspirants and did so on an extremely accelerated development schedule. The results were excellent. The new Raven Guard Astartes lacked combat experience, but they were even more capable than typical Raven Guard Space Marines. They were named the Raptors and placed under the overall command of Captain Brawne, who served as the Legion's master of recruits. They received their baptism by fire in a successful assault against a Word Bearer's intelligence outpost, and they proved themselves worthy. For a moment, the impossible seemed to have become real. The 19th Legion's reconstruction looked bright, but the Alpha Legion had been waiting for exactly this moment. The Alpha Legion did not strike in haste. They did not rush. They did not gamble. They waited, patiently, until the Raven Guard achieved the genetic breakthrough. While Korax and his apothecaries worked, the Alpha Legion was already fomenting rebellion among the old tech guilds of Kievar, the forge world that Deliverance orbited. They assembled an Alpha Legion force nearby, while simultaneously misleading both their normal allies among the other traitor legions and their supposed allies in the Cabal about their true purpose. And inside the Raven Guard, the hidden knife was already in place. With the helps of adepts from the Dark Mechanicum, Alpha Legion operatives embedded within the 19th Legion contaminated the pure Primarch gene stock held by the Raven Guard. They used a virus tainted with demonic essence. The Alpha Legionaries themselves did not know the true nature of the virus until after the contamination was complete, because their Dark Mechanicum allies had insisted it could be easily extracted once the original Primarch gene stock came into their possession. The second wave came next. 2,000 newborn Raven Guard Astartes. And it was a disaster. As soon as the gene seed organs were implanted, the recruits manifested hideous warp-related mutations. Many had to be kept imprisoned. The accelerated program that had seemed like salvation curdled into horror almost overnight. Korax looked upon what had been done and still claimed them. "Mutation or not," declared, "they were as much part of the Raven Guard as any of his Astartes." He vowed to find a way to reverse the corruption. Yet the damage was profound. 90% of the recruits who underwent the accelerated treatments were unable to hold a standard Space Marine bolt gun, let alone fire it. Of 100 recruits, perhaps one possessed a genome stable enough to become a true Space Marine. While Korax fought to salvage what he could, the Alpha Legion's wider plan reached its climax. The rebellion on Kievar was well underway, supported by the newly arrived Alpha Legion force, camouflaged as Raven Guard, bearing the 19th Legion's badges, insignia, and armor. But this violence was not the true thrust. It was a diversion. Because the Alpha Legion's purpose was twofold. First, to steal the Primarch gene stock. Second, to completely destroy the Raven Guard's existing gene seed and cripple the Loyalist Legion. The first objective succeeded. The original Primarch DNA, and all information about it, was secured by Omegon, who had been secretly on Kievar the entire time, manipulating events as needed. But the second objective, total destruction of the Raven Guard's gene seed, failed. It was prevented by the Raven Guard mutants. Those broken recruits, so newly made and so cruelly twisted, became the difference between extinction and survival. Tasked by the dying Chief Apothecary Vincente VI to save the Legion's future, they acted to preserve what could be preserved. Korax did not cast them aside. He allowed the mutants who could fight to join the Legion's raptor squads. They fought beside the rest of the Raven Guard, alongside a small force of Imperial Fists, and the reconstituted Therian cohort in the first counterattack against the traitors. They went on to fight in the Raven Guard's successful campaign against the garrison of an Emperor's Children's held planet near the Kievar system. But even victory could not restore what had been lost. The attempt to rebuild the 19th Legion's strength lay in ruins. The shortcut had failed, poisoned from within. The cost was not only in dead and broken bodies, but in the knowledge that Korax had tried to cheat time, and time had answered with tragedy. With a heavy heart, Korax accepted the truth. His attempt to refill his Legion's ranks by accelerated means had been a mistake. From then on, the Raven Guard would rebuild in the traditional way. Slowly, painstakingly, transforming young human aspirants into Space Marines over many standard years of genetic alteration and training. The price was devastating in strategic terms. It meant the Raven Guard would not be able to participate in a meaningful way in the defense of the Imperium against the traitor legions during the Horus Heresy. But Korax would not abandon the war. He would simply fight it the only way his shattered legion still could. Lacking the manpower to meet traitor legions in open battle, the Raven Guard embraced a doctrine of predation. They would stalk the enemy supply lines, They would strike at worlds far from the front that were still of strategic value. They would become a persistent wound, bleeding Horus's war machine out one cut at a time. Over the following Terran years, the Raven Guard attacked convoys, sabotaged weapons deliveries, decimated planetary occupation forces, destroyed orbital shipping yards, liberated worker camps, and became a constant thorn in the War Master's side. Every starship destroyed meant one less vessel to ferry troops to the inevitable siege of Terra. Every weapon shipment annihilated meant one less shot fired at the defenders of the Imperial Palace. Every world liberated reduced trader manufacturing capabilities. This became the Raven Guard's new mode of thinking. If you could not strike at the enemy directly, hit them where it hurt. When the Horus Heresy ended, and the legions were reorganized into chapters during the second founding, the Raven Guard were left largely inoperable as a combat unit. During the time of rebirth, they spent solar decades recruiting new members and rebuilding what had been broken. Still undermanned and under-equipped after the massacre at Istvan V, the Raven Guard honed and perfected covert, small-unit guerrilla tactics. Methods requiring little in the way of heavy armor, fire support, or large reserves of equipment that the chapter and its limited successors simply did not possess. Even into the 41st millennium, their lack of predators, land raiders, and the latest patterns of power armor would reflect those dire conditions. The shadow of scarcity stretching forward across 10,000 years. After Horus's defeat, Korax welcomed Gilliman's decision to split the legions. He understood the necessity of preventing another rebellion like the Heresy. But Korax would not walk easily into that future. He disappeared, consumed by the tragic acts he had committed to save his gene sons. His ultimate fate, reflecting so much of his life, remained hidden in mystery. Before his disappearance, there was one final act, quiet, terrible, and personal. Korax personally gave the Emperor's peace to every surviving mutant created by the 19th Legion's accelerated program. Afterward, he'd locked himself in his personal chambers in the Raven Spire on Deliverance and begged the recently ascended Emperor for forgiveness. The guilt did not lift. Unable to truly alleviate it, Korax left the Raven Spire exactly one Terran year after he first entered seclusion. He boarded a transport bound for the Eye of Terror. His last recorded words as he departed Deliverance were, "Nevermore." His chapter has never learned his fate. A handful of centuries after Korax's disappearance, the Raven Guard's gene seed began to deteriorate. Some suggested the cause lay in the accelerated gene harvesting techniques employed in ages past. Several organs unique to Space Marines no longer functioned as they should, and every attempt to compensate for the damage failed. As a result, much of the Raven Guard's genetic material had to be drawn from undamaged gene stocks, tithed and stored on Terra by Adeptus Mechanicus Genitors during the Second Founding. Viable gene seed became scarce. That scarcity reshaped the chapter. The Raven Guard became more scrupulous than most in selection, testing, and training. Inductees spent far longer in the 10th Company, as Scout Marines or Vanguard Marines, than was typical of other chapters. And the Raven Guard rarely went to battle without significant numbers of these aspirants supporting them. Even so, they refused to soften their pace. Their assaults continued. Their wars did not stop simply because replacement was slow. Grueling campaigns sometimes left the chapter operating at perilously understrength levels for extended periods. Though famed for indirect warfare, Raven Guard did not shy from costly frontal assaults when required. They would attack with everything the Adeptus Astartes could bring to bear. But they held to a belief that tactical prowess and personal initiative mattered more than raw force. In the era leading up to the opening of the Great Rift, much of the Raven Guard's strength was deployed on the eastern fringe against the expanding Tau Empire. In the bloodshed of the Perfectia campaign, Chapter Master Corvin Severax fell. He was replaced by the former Shadow Captain, Kayvon Shrike. Shrike fragmented the chapter's strength and deployed them across the Segmentum Tempestus and Segmentum Pacificus in a number of covert operations. What goal these scattered campaigns serve, the Chapter Master has not revealed. But his enemies have learned, again and again, that nothing Shrike does is without purpose.